Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, someone must have come to my previous Dharma talks. Keep a safe distance. Or maybe it's not about me here. Are you guys all the people who would sit on the back of the school bus? Maybe so. So it's lovely to be here this morning. I'm going to talk a little bit about a very small part of an old poem called the Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. I think you guys get some copies. Looks like it. Cool. You don't have to read those. Don't worry. We'll get our chance. This is a pretty complex and lengthy poem, so I think it's fair to say it wouldn't be hard to give 40 or 50 Dharma talks based on this poem, so I'll be focusing on a very small aspect of it today. And I'm going to talk about it for a few minutes, and then we can have an opportunity to chant it together. Can you guys hear me back there? Can you hear me over there? All right, cool. Once you can't hear me, you can just go, hey. Okay, I'll try and pay attention. The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi is written around the 9th century by a Soto Zen teacher named Dongshan, actually generally thought to be one of the founders of the what's now known as the Soto Zen lineage. And he opens the poem by saying, "The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well." The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. So we may already have started to run up against words whose meaning are obscure. So first let me just talk about the word Dharma. Dharma has two principal meanings. Sometimes we say big D Dharma, which means the teaching of Buddhism or the truth. And small D Dharma, which means phenomena. So like a small D Dharma would be like whiteness. So in your field of vision right now, there's patches of whiteness, right? Those are dharmas. Or a dharma could be a sound phenomena, like you're hearing sounds coming from this part of the room. Those are dharmas. Or also you might have feelings, like, whoa, is this talk going to be really esoteric? You know, what's going on? That's a dharma too. So any kind of phenomena, it's a small D dharma. Big D dharma is this idea of a teaching which is true, which is really beneficial. And ultimately, though, the really cool thing about Mahayana Buddhism is it collapses these. So the thing is, phenomena are the truth. In fact, in most Mahayana Buddhist thought, the only real accessible truth is momentary, phenomenal experience right now. So, big D, small D, all one dharma. So this is why Dogen Zenji once wrote, earth, grasses and trees, fences, tiles, walls, pebbles, all things in the dharma realm carry out the Buddha work. And this actually comes directly from Dongshan's realization, or the thing that really questioned that he carried through the early years of his practice. He heard that all inanimate objects and animate objects preach the Dharma. He was like, how's that happen? I thought I'd just go and, like, the teacher said stuff, and that's going to be true. But what this teacher that Yunyan said, all things preach the Dharma. And he thought, How is that? Because the only truth we really access is in this moment of our direct experience. So another word for this truth as revealed right here is thusness. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted. Thusness is just like as it isness. It's how things are now. It includes everything. But the little twist about thusness is it's not what you think it is. The things you think about it are not separate from thusness. But thusness is not what you think it is. So in this moment, we all think, I'm in this space, I could tell you the date, I'm here, you're there. All those are just ideas. They're not separate from thusness, but they're not actually what it is, which is beyond any ideas we can have. All the ideas we have make a sense of separation, of little objects bumping up against each other and worrying each other over time. And thusness is complete. It's completeness that's already here. So when he says the Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted, he both means that this kind of teaching that I'm giving, that the only truth is this truth of direct experience, but also that the kind of that what we do, what Buddhas and ancestors transmit, is just things being as they are already. Which doesn't seem like it would take very much effort, does it? And yet, those of us who are committed to realizing this path, we go, oh yeah, thusness, that's cool. And then our mind immediately falls into dividing everything up and we're very confused. How mysterious! So, the human mind is conditioned to take the realm, total realm of experience, which includes sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, feelings, thoughts, take all that and do this. What am I going to look at? So it goes, oh yes, I remember her. Very good. Friend of mine. Yeah, good feeling. Who is that? I'm not sure. Does she belong here?
What's wrong with me?
So, for those of you listening to this on tape, I'm making a tiny little viewing tube with my hands. Right, so I'm kind of like a pirate on a ship, a vast, beautiful ocean. I'm like, where's something I can steal? Or like perhaps someone crossing from Europe to the Americas 500 years ago going, where's something I can steal? Even though they're convinced, where's something I can discover? So this is just the way the mind is, and it does this all the time. So there's this vast wholeness revealed in experience, but what we feel we're experiencing is this tiny little image caught in the grasp of our hands. So Buddhism presents two particular common methodologies for trying to open up to thusness. So I'm just going to talk briefly about the distinction between mindfulness and traditional Zen practice, or I'll say Zazen here. So with mindfulness, what you do is you progressively say, my mind just tends to go like zoink, 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 zoink. It's jumping around all the time. So I'm going to stabilize it on specific things in order. The mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness are body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. So we take that tube and we go, okay, what's the body like? And we take the tube and say, what are the feelings like? Then we take the tube and what are the thoughts like? And we move that, we use the viewing tube tendency of our mind to draw ourselves to an awareness of parts of our experience that are normally obscure to us, or we ignore. And this is really helpful. And each of those things is subdivided, because it's Indian Buddhism, so with the body we start with breath, and then posture, and then activity, and then so on and so forth. So this is great. Conversely, traditionally in Zen practice, what we do is we just say, we just let open the hand of thought. Just let it happen. We just sit still long enough that our hands open up. And the hole's already here. It's already here. So just not saying, oh, now I got to open my hands. That's just another viewing tube. Are my hands open right now or not? Just letting them open. Like a flower. Now, personally, I think both methods are valuable and to be integrated. And the principal reason is I'm trained more in the just letting the hands open. But the little downside of that, I'm not going to critique mindfulness because we do less of it here. The downside of the opening the hand is you might get your hands pretty open, and then there's this one little part of you that just really doesn't want to get seen. And you go, like, I'm really open. But then it's like, yeah, you know, but when that guy talks, brrr. So with mindfulness, we can say, what are those? We can use it to turn and illuminate and be aware of these corners of our experience that are obscured. It's bring them into the whole. They're already in the whole, but bring them into our awareness or immersion in the whole of thusness. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. Intimate transmission. It's teacher to student, mind to mind, warm hand to warm hand. So I received transmission from my teacher, Tim. And I actually was just at a Vietnamese temple last night, and the nun said, I know this is a very private question, so you can say no. It was like a panel in front of like people. She said, what was the moment of transmission for you? And I was like, oh, man. This one? So the transmission I experienced with my teacher is, we've sat in this room in the morning, the main thing we've done is just come here and sit in the morning for Zazen a couple times a week for about a dozen years. We don't usually talk to each other. You know, we just come in. It's pretty early. Who wants to talk at 5:45? And we just come in. We sit down. We chant the Heart Sutra. We make some bows. And we leave. Not trying to make something happen. We're just settling down into just this. But just in case this is making you think, man, I just got to get some of that thusness. Once I get some of that thusness, it's going to be pretty good. Just remember, Dongshan will say later on in his poem, whether teachings and approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. You can't actually hold it back. It's not controllable, graspable, manipulatable. It's really big. It's a little, oh, I got it. I got a little part. It's going to be cool. I'm going to make my dollars today. It's just blowing. So anyway, the whole Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi is about this transmission of thusness and really about talking about thusness. And so every time it says it, it's going to be referring to thusness, and it says a million freaky things about it. Some of them may be inspiring. Some of them may be completely impenetrable. But I would like to chant this poem together now. And I will just say the activity of chanting, what do? We listen. We create sound, see the words on the paper, and transmit them into vocal sound. And you don't have to do anything more than that. You don't have to understand it. It's not even encouraged to try and figure it out. Be whole. Be whole with the activity of just making the sound. Completeness. So I'll chant the title, and then we can chant the whole thing together. Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, preserve it well. A silver bowl filled with snow, a heron hidden in the moon, taken as similar, they are not the same. Not distinguished, their places are known. The meaning does not reside in the words, but a pivotal moment brings it forth. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. Just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. In darkest night it is perfectly clear. In the light of dawn it is hidden. It is a standard for all things. Its use removes all suffering. Although it is not constructed, it is not beyond words. Like facing a precious mirror,
form and reflection behold each other. You are not it, but in truth it is you. Like a newborn child, it is fully endowed with five aspects. No going, no coming, no arising, no hiding. Po po hung hung, is anything said or not? In the end it says nothing, for the words are not yet right. In the hexagram, double fire, when main and subsidiary lines are transposed, piled up, they become five, like the permeations made five, like the place of the five flavored herb, like the five pronged vajra, wondrously embraced within the complete, drumming and singing begin together. Penetrate the source and travel the pathways. Embrace the territory and treasure the roads. You would do well to respect this. Do not neglect it. Natural and wondrous, it is not a matter of delusion or enlightenment. Within causes and conditions, time and season, it is serene and illuminating. So minute it enters where there is no gap. So vast it transcends dimension. A hair's breadth deviation and you are out of tune. Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. With teachings and approaches distinguished, each has its standard. Whether teachings and approaches are mastered or not, reality constantly flows. Outside still and inside trembling, like tethered colts or cowering rats. The ancient sages greeted for them and taught for them the Dharma. Led by their inverted views, they take black or white. When inverted thinking stops, the affirming mind naturally accords. If you want to follow in the ancient tracks, please observe the sages of the past. One on the verge of realizing the Buddha way, contemplated a tree for 10 kalpas. Like a battle-scarred tiger, like a horse with shanks gone gray. Because some are vulgar, jeweled tables and ornate robes. Because others are wide-eyed, cats and white oxen. With his archer's skill, he hit the mark at 100 paces. But when arrows weak head on, how could it be a matter of skill? The wooden man starts to sing. The subtle woman gets up dancing. It is not reached by feelings or consciousness. How could it involve deliberation? Ministers serve their lords. Children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial. Failure to serve is no help. With practice hidden, punching secretly, like a fool, like an idiot. Just to continue in this way is called the host within the host.
Well, I'm sure you got that one figured out. This is rife with references to countless other teachings, evocations, paradoxes. It's kind of like Zen literature. So I want to talk here. I wanted to kind of introduce thusness, especially as it relates to the practice of mindfulness and Zazen at the beginning. And I want to talk about a particular aspect of thusness that Dongshan brings up here. And he brings up a lot, but he introduces the theme in the second line. The Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. So, what does Dogen say in the Genjo Koan? When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. So, you don't have to wait to be some better you. Things are already whole within this total moment of experience. Now you have it. Now, There is some conjecture that this originally was supposed to be a secret transmission text that was like, so, you know, like when you gave transmission to your student, you'd be like, now you have it. A few generations later, someone asked Zen master from the Soto Zen lineage, Furong Daokai, what is the style of the master's house? And Furong Daokai said, everyone can see it. I don't have any secrets. You're seeing it. It's not like there's some hidden truth about this, or about our teaching, or about ourselves. You just trust your eyes. But then the puzzling thing is, he says, now you have it, preserve it well. So if we take this kind of idea that this is like this transmission text, and he's like, come on, I've given you a transmission, take care of this lineage, honor this tradition. And this is good to remember, that when we come here, if you make a commitment to this practice, you're carrying something forward that people devoted their whole lives to, countless people. In particular, I'll point out, many, many people from cultures different than ours. Respect this. Honor them. Make those connections. But what's most puzzling is, what does it happen? What does it mean when someone says, preserve thusness? One, it's momentary. And two, it includes everything. You can't get in there and manipulate it. What a strange invitation to just pour yourself into something that's already whole. So, I actually did not have the opportunity to look at the original Chinese with this, but I will say that one way to think about this is, take care of it. Now you have it. Take care of it. Take care of this whole thing. Don't take care of the little part, like, I'm going to look at that thing so I can get what I need for me. If you're doing that, if you're taking care of yourself, take care of it for the whole. The whole needs you to be well. In the Dhammapada, one of the earliest Buddhist texts, it says, the fools take delight in selfish deeds until they see the results. When they see the results, they suffer. We think, when we're in this little narrow tube of seeing, that it's going to work out great for us. But it's too narrow. Non-suffering is produced by seeing the whole. It doesn't mean you don't like eat food and take time to be well. It means you do it with a sense of the whole, how that's beneficial for the whole. Well, this is why when we eat during sashimi here, we don't say, could I have some more of that cake? We say, we receive this food for the enlightenment of all beings. So not only does he say, now you have it, preserve it well, he says, you would do well to respect this. Do not neglect it. Don't neglect this moment. It's so easy to neglect it. There's so much here, and it's like, I'm walking down the street, and I don't even know what's happening. Because I'm just like, well, let's see, now what am I going to say to them when I get there? I think, why did he say that to me that way? And there's all this life that's obscured, that's missed. Seeing this tiny corner. Oh, and you guys are still here. You're still here. Then towards the end, he says, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial. Failure to serve is no help. Serving thusness. For those of you familiar with the teachings of the host and the guest, the minister is the guest. The Lord is the host, the whole, enlightenment, realization, serving an already complete whole. This is not something that makes a lot of sense to our conventional way of thinking, but is fundamental to Dongshan's vision. When Dongshan was dying, one of his students came and said, the master is ill. But is there anyone who does not get ill? Dongshan said, there is. The student said, does the one who does not get ill look after you? Dongshan said, I have the opportunity to look after him. So illness, I mean, this is the basic idea of Buddhism. There's illness and there's wellness. The world has illness in it. We can do something about it. That's what this whole tradition is about. But there's this idea that illness is a pervasive quality. But there's also the idea of nirvana or enlightenment, where there is no illness. Or thusness, where things are complete. That there's a completeness here. That the brokenness of your body is still part of the whole. That the brokenness of your heart is still part of the whole. Is there anyone who does not get ill? Dongshan said, there is. Monk said, does the one who does not get ill look after you? Is this wonderful completeness taking care of you and enveloping you? Maybe so, but Dongshan said, I have the opportunity to look after him. Preserve it well. Do not neglect it. Failure to serve is no help. Pouring your energy into an unknowable whole instead of grinding out this life of trying to manipulate apparently external objects to try and be a better person, to try and make other people get in line, to try and get what you need. So let go of it all and in this moment say, this thing, what can I offer? And then on to the next one. This thing, what can I offer? Suzuki Roshi used to say you should practice with no gaining idea. No gaining idea. And here's a broad theme. I mean, I think he was mostly talking about, you know, people have come to the Zendo and they're like, you read some books about enlightenment, you're like, I got to get me some of that. I'm going to get me some of this thusness. You can't get it. You can't get something that's always already here. It's not gettable. Non-attaining. So, there's this non-attainable quality. Dongshan says, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. And then immediately says, just to portray it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. So you're like, well, I can't touch it. I can't get away from it. And then he says, and I'm doing it wrong too. Because I just made this vivid literary image. You can't get it. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Well, wait a minute. I thought if I stayed still, I was trapped. What's going on? You're not going to figure this out. This is figuring it out. This is opening the hand of thought. So this is the point where people go, I think I'm going to go to the Insight Meditation Society. Where they're going to teach me some progressive practices where I can cultivate a... And we do that here too. So we grow. I mean, I don't think very many people I know would come here if they weren't growing. If they didn't think this was helping them contribute to the healing of the world. But these kind of teachings are trying to soften that relentlessness of our grasping. But to immerse yourself in this approach that isn't about getting results for yourself. Oh, I got what I wanted. It's like a little mouse in a labyrinth. Ooh, I did something and then I felt better. Angela Davis, the philosopher and professor and African-American civil rights activist, once said, sometimes we have to do the work even though there's not even a glimmer of hope on the horizon that it's going to be possible. Sometimes we have to do the work even though there's not even a glimmer of hope on the horizon that it's going to be possible. Of course, first, when I say this, I just feel the pain that that assertion must carry to be in a position of oppression that's so pervasive, with such profound history and just be like, yep, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to do this again. But this is our way. Buddha didn't say, yeah, samsara is kind of a pain in the butt, but if you practice for a couple weeks, you'll get it all taken care of and you'll control this and that and it'll be cool. He said that the problem of human suffering is vast. It's an immense, eon-long rolling ball. But you can always do something about it. And at the end of this talk, as we do every Sunday, we'll chant the four vows. And there's all about this doing the work. Yeah, I mean, like, does anyone here think that we're going to finish off with the inexhaustible delusions? I can see the vows written up there. Now, you can't all see them, but there's 28 characters. 8 of them are about the limitlessness of the situation that we're diving into, the limitlessness of the problem. Just dive in. And then sometimes there's no problem because you're just diving. Whole in the diving within thusness. So, Bell Hooks is an activist who's very closely associated as a formative force in coming up with what's called intersectional theory. Bell Hooks is someone I admire a lot. She's alive now, teaching somewhere. Intersectional theory is basically the idea that there are lots of different systems of oppression and that they interrelate. So, you know, she was like, well, I want to be advocating for racial justice, but within that, I'm also experiencing sexist depression. And then she's trying to talk to one person about the one thing, and they say, no, we're talking about this. No, we're talking about this. I don't want to talk about that. And she's like, wait a minute. This doesn't work. And so she said, we need to just realize that there's this huge rolling mass of things that harm people. I just found this quote. It's not by Bell Hooks, but a woman whose name I forgot to write down. But it was quoted in an article by Hooks. Aspects of identity are not unitary, mutually exclusive entities, but rather reciprocally constructing phenomena. Is anyone familiar with Mahayana Buddhism? You say here? Aspects of identity are not unitary, mutually exclusive entities, but rather reciprocally constructing phenomena. So, I don't know about you, but sometimes it's like I went to McAllister College a long time ago, and it was like just this cacophony of competing voices about the different kinds of oppression, and people would just be like, "Oh God, I just got to get out of this college so I can do my life." But it's real. People suffer, so I can be like, "I don't want to put that in my lens. I'm going to go somewhere else." Or I can say, I'm here to hear. I'm here to hear. Yes, this is part of the whole, the thusness I'm presented with. And intersectional theory is frustrating because people go, what, are we just going to talk forever about systems of oppression? Yes. That's what Buddhism is about. Your mind is conditioned to be involved of systems of oppression. Not only on systemic levels for people because of race or class or gender or sexual orientation, or I'm going to stop, but please, I love you all. But also just within oppressing yourself, attacking yourself, or ignoring, skipping. It's a big invitation, like, oh, geez, I don't want to do it. You could do it. Your heart is big. Your heart is big. You just got to let it be part of the whole. So, this is about moment to moment, this preserving thusness, just meeting this whole, saying I'm willing to keep coming back to that project, which isn't even a project, because you're already part of the whole. It's not that hard. It seems hard, and then you do it, and you're like, well, that was the easiest thing I ever did. We spend too much time talking about how hard it is to do a long retreat. Sometimes it's very easy. I know sometimes it's hard. I'm like, ow, my body. Sometimes it's so easy. There's nothing but these people I love and a cup of tea. It's whole. I'm not trying to get something from it. Just pouring myself into it. I think I've heard Tim many times say, we come here for morning zazen, and after zazen we do service, and we bow down and we put our head on the floor. And the language I always use, I give myself away. Just give yourself away to the whole. You're safe. So last week, you know, but it's like, what is it? If I'm already part of the whole, how can I give myself to it? Yeah, it's a little puzzling. That's just true. And that came up during the talk last week because Boucher was talking about the universe calls and you answer, but you're a call and the universe answers. Like, well, what even is this self? Dongshan says, the Dharma of thusness is intimately transmitted by Buddhists and ancestors. Now you have it. Preserve it well. A silver bowl filled with snow. A heron hidden in the moon. A heron hidden in the moon. So this was really puzzling until I realized that the word for heron refers to a white bird. What we call an egret. So suppose you walk outside and the moon is in the sky. Right now it's blue, but the moon is white. There's a heron flying, white. You think, oh, there's a heron, and there's the moon. And then the heron disappears into the moon, into whiteness. The moon, in our tradition, symbolizes this whole, the enlightenment, the completeness, thusness, that we're usually not seeing. We only see these little objects moving around. I wonder if the heron will actually go in front of the moon. That'd be so cool. When the heron is hidden in the moon, is the heron gone? So, we just want to have these little objects, our mind. Well, I don't know if we want to. Our mind is conditioned to create objects and then go like, yeah, well, if I just get there on time, everything will be all right. I won't be a bad person. I don't know about you guys. I don't like being late. You know, worrying about these little things. How am I going to control this relationship? Whatever it is. We're not seeing the moon. We're not seeing our immersion in it. Black Elk, the Lakota shaman, once said, only to white man was nature a wilderness full of wild animals and savage people. To us it was bountiful, and we are surrounded by the blessings of the great mystery. Only to the white man was the world a wilderness, populated by wild animals and savage people. To us it was bountiful, and we are surrounded by the blessings of the great mystery. So, there's a lot there, but in this context, our mind is like, oh, this world is too wild. I can't deal with all of this. There's too much here. Well, can I just take a little piece of it and try and like live in there? This narrow shell of just thinking about my little group of people or my little group of concerns. And then can I get them to go the way I want to? Like, I like buffalo skin, so how about if I kill a bunch of buffalo, like maybe 40 million? Used to be 40 million buffalo. Wow. Wild animals. But the real thing about this quotation that touches my heart is he says, we are surrounded by the blessings of the great mystery. The mystery part is the most important part. It's opening up your hand and letting it be mysterious. Do you know this feeling? You sit zazen for a while, or a half an hour, or a week, or 20 years, and you're just walking, and it's mysterious, and you can let it be mysterious. But you pour yourself into that moment. Someone presents to you a viewpoint you don't like, and instead of being like, where's my argument? You go, wow, I'm here with you. This is complete. Moment to moment, offering your life to an unknowable whole. That's the invitation of this talk. Thank you. I invite other people to speak. Questions or observations, all welcome.
So it's challenging enough to grasp the meaning of the words in your own language. Can you talk a little bit more about translation?
Translation. Well, at the bottom, any act that involves language is already translation. So no word has an independent meaning outside of your experience of it. So like when I say, you are not it, but in truth it is you, everyone here was involved in an act of translation just as I did that. It's not that that means the same thing to everyone here. So that's just a basic underpinning, that the idea that there's a fixed meaning to anything is never true. That's just Mahayana thought, right? Also Wittgenstein, I think. Right. It's amazing how many Western innovations were well established in other cultures for hundreds or thousands of years. Anyway, so translation, though, you're probably talking about a more practical level. It does, you know, one hopefully is trying to convey what the text says, but there's always going to be an interpretive aspect because of corollary A that I stated. So, yeah, it's nice to try and find people who are really committed to understanding both languages, to respecting the original text, but trying to communicate with the current people. I can say that. I don't know. Do you have a more specific kind of question about it?
I'm just fascinated that ideas can become words, and then words can become different words, and then they can become ideas again.
Yeah. Well, that's that. I feel like that pertains that aspects of, instead of identity, I'll say language, are not unitary, mutually exclusive entities, but rather reciprocally constructing phenomena. So we're making it now. Yes.
I have a question, because when people talk about being awake versus being asleep, is that? I would find it somewhat annoying. Am I awake? Am I asleep? I don't know. But how does it relate to this and this?
Well, I assume you're not just talking about, like, during sesshin you wish you could sleep. So I think people are talking about being, like, aware or unaware or something. But I think, generally speaking, you know, to be asleep is to not only be absorbed in this process of narrowing, but not even know you're doing it. You know, you're like sitting zazen, and you're like, what just happened for the last 5 minutes? I have no idea. But now I'm going to see what it's like here. And we become intimate with that aspect of our experience through this process. Intimate. Just opening up. Not controlling.
You ever find that, like, so you have, like, this, like, considering the perspective of, like, a frog, and like a frog has like momentary experience, but the frog also has this genealogy in, that goes way back to the first. I'm assuming that there was one single moment of bursting into life from the mineral world, and then so you know the frog is not. You know, we think he's a relatively, or she, a relatively simple organism, but the complexity, you know, this is pretty standard, is very complex. And so, and also the longevity of the entity is infinite, going all the way back into mineral, to the Big Bang. So, there isn't really such a thing as a moment. I mean, there is momentary experience, but it does a disservice to the frog to think that even the frog can be apprehended in a single instant of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's precisely true. So I'll cite Dogen here. Dogen, basically, one of the absolute pivots of his teaching is that he says there are two ways that is beneficial to view time. One is total momentariness, which is what this poem is about. And the other is infinite interconnectedness through every spatial or temporal conceivable way and way beyond that. So absolute infinite interconnectedness. The way that is not helpful to view time is like, now I'm this, now I'm that, I'm still this, I'm a slightly different version of this. So normally our mind is viewing linear time and chopping things up. Chop, 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 chop. He says thusness and infiniteness. That's what Uji is about. And in this case, the emphasis of this talk was the thusness side, but I think you're absolutely correct. Yes. Yeah.
I think something that helped me a lot is I do a lot of thinking and writing. And more often than not, what I'm trying to get is already here. And so what I've noticed is that so using the word realize is helpful because, you know, with, you can't get thusness, but with a change in perspective, somehow you might realize it's already here. And so when I can catch myself trying to get something like a more loving family, I often will turn that into a sort of prayer. May I realize that I already have this. Mm-hmm. And somehow just turn it into a prayer for may I realize this thing that's already here. And then I sort of set that aside and just go about my stuff. Inevitably, it shows up. So that's helpful for me.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And just from my personal experience, I'll just say the realizing that I already have a loving family is like realizing the wholeness that's here. So when I want connection, I start to arrow in. I'm going to get the connection there. That's the person. That's the people who are going to give it to me. And if that connection is not there, it becomes very painful. I realize the connection is available in a much bigger way. I'll try to narrow it down and grab it here. It's painful. So I that rings really true to my experience.
I don't think it's a question of this, but I just feeling this feeling of this idea of contrast used in different ways, maybe in positive and negative ways. That like, well, the hair on the moon. That we sometimes take comfort as far as doing good in the world or not wanting to, feeling that like it's overwhelming to do the work of doing good in the world. It's easier to sit in non-contrast, to sit where you're not seeing contrasting ways of or living out in the world. So you insulate yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We insulate ourselves. And then there's using contrast to get out of your painful situations and just do something different than wanting to do otherwise.
Mm.
The again, I've seen that in that. But the hair and the moon, and then and not helpful to not help.
Failure to serve is no help. Yeah. Yeah, and this isn't about denying individuality or denying the heron. It's just human beings are so fixated on the apparently divided up, rubbing against each other world that I need a lot of help to remember, there's also this. Thus. It's hard to trust it. Hard to totally give yourself to something you have a hard time trusting. We come together to build that trust. So I think. Oh, do you want to? Let's see one more.
Is this chanted regularly in some sort of Zen contexts, on like special occasions, or is it chanted like in the morning?
It's a pretty standard chanting text. Probably, I'm just going to pull this out of my hat, but maybe one of the top five or six most commonly chanted texts in Soto Zen, maybe top ten. So in many contexts, and so one of the reasons I like to do it is people here don't have that many opportunities to do that, so it's a way of immersing yourself in the language. Yeah.
Part of the moon service at Hokyoji is actually the mountain name of Hokyoji is
Let's all go down there this week. And if you can't come, we're still together. Whole. So we should wrap up here. Thank you all very much.